From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The playwright Harold Pinter must have been an intimidating presence. He was brilliant and opinionated. His plays could be dark and vicious, the language always so precise. The actor Julian Sands says Pinter gave off an electrical charge that left you feeling if you shook his hand, you'd be electrocuted. So he must have felt a little trepidation when Pinter asked him to replace him in a recital of his poetry. Sands didn't know much about the poems, but he took the part. Pinter died in 2008, and Julian Sands has turned the recital into a one-man show, which he's performing at Weber State University on Friday. Today in the program, Sands is joining us to talk about the life revealed in those poems. He calls it a celebration of Harold Pinter. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you know Harold Pinter's work, it's probably because of his plays. The actor Julian Sands says Pinter became something of a heroic figure to him when he began his training. Actors, he says, love doing Pinter because the language is so rich, the humor is so subversive, the characters, they can be violent and vicious. But Sands says Pinter's plays don't reveal who he was. For that, you'd have to read his poetry. Some of you may be surprised that Pinter wrote poems. Julian Sands didn't know much about his poetry until, in 2005, Pinter asked Sands to read some of it in a recital of his work. Pinter was too ill with cancer to do the performance. Harold Pinter died in 2008. Sands performed a version of that recital as a memorial. Eventually, it became a theatrical piece, a one-man show, and on Friday, Julian Sands is going to be in Utah to perform it, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about Harold Pinter and see what his poetry revealed about his life. You can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Julian Sands is an actor, of course, in film, stage, and television. He's appeared in films like The Killing Fields, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and in the TV series 24, Smallville. He's going to be performing the show. It's called A Celebration of Harold Pinter at Weber State University, directed by John Malkovich, by the way, and we'll give you details about all of that as we go along. Today, Julian Sands is joining us from a studio in Los Angeles. And Julian Sands, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Well, good morning. I'm delighted to be able to share this hour with you and your listeners.
Well, I was trying to give the exposition there, Julian Sands, about how this came to you. Let's say a little bit more. This is 2005, it was. Harold Pinter had committed to giving a charity recital of his poems, couldn't perform them because of his illness, and he happened to ask you.
That's right. I mean, you have the facts. We were having lunch. There were a number of people there. I'd been talking to him about David Hare's play, Stuff Happens, in which I'd just been playing the then British Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Right.
And, of course, Harold had a lot of opinions about Tony Blair. And but it led to a very animated conversation between us, at the end of which he said, look, you know, I've got this recital coming up, but I'm not going to be able to do it. The voice just won't handle the acoustical challenges of this vast church in the City of London, St. Stephen Warbrook, designed by Christopher Wren. And he said, but I would like you to do it for me. Will you do that? And, of course, it filled me with dread when he then said, but, of course, we'll have to spend time together. which and also it gets tremendous excitement and anticipation, because Harold had been a great hero of mine, a theatrical hero. I mean, when I studied his texts for school, high school in England in the 1970s, I was transported by his plays, his characters, the language, the landscape. I hadn't come across anything like it before. I pursued productions whenever possible. And at drama school, we always used Harold's text as basis for our scene work. And I did a film of one of his plays, right. The Room.
Yeah, Robert Altman.
Robert Altman.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, I played the menacing Mr. Sands, and Annie Lennox played Mrs. Sands. Donald Pleasance and Linda Hunt were also in the cast. It was, at the time, you know, I went to see the film with great anticipation, but I didn't know what to make of it. And later, when I discussed it with Harold, neither did he. However, I've seen it again recently, and it's with some relief and some pride, I can tell your listeners, that the film is very faithful to Harold's play. The performances are striking and the direction clinical, so I recommend it.
What was it like to have lunch with Harold Pinter? I mean, you've talked about wasn't really into casual conversation, wasn't much on small talk necessarily. And I'm sure that – I think you've said that you could get tongue-tied. I'm sure anyone would. And you just sort of listened to Harold Pinter,
I guess. Yes. Well, he was a great man to listen to.
Right.
And you always hoped he wouldn't ask you a direct question because his the economy and the precision of his – of his speech, of his talking, and the acuteness of his listening was intimidating, not just to me, to a great, you know, many people who've reported of their encounters with Harold. He did have the capacity to leave one tongue-tied. However, his use of language was quite brilliant. In its choice of words, in its visceral expression of his thought, very powerful and very compelling voice. I think you've seen his Nobel lecture as recorded by him in a studio in London, in order that it could be broadcast in Stockholm, and even. In his frailty, he's such a powerful and authoritative speaker.
It's extraordinary.
I recommend that. We're
going to play a bit of that toward the end of the program.
Oh, good.
Because
good.
He reads a poem, "Death," which I wanted to play some of that too, and have you talk about. I think it's. We'll talk about those pauses too, I think, as we go along. How did you see the character that you're taking on in this show, though? I say character. Of course, you're reading Pinter's work. You're using his style, his pauses, his inflections. But it's not like it's an impersonation. I mean, how do you describe it?
Well, it came about quite organically, as we discussed this recital for which Harold tutored me.
Yeah.
Over several sessions in his study in very intimate circumstances. He was very exact about the content of the work, the structures, the emphases, the pauses, how he wanted it delivered, almost like a conductor talking to a or the composer talking to the musician. Mm. He was very precise about that, and which was immensely helpful to me as a performer, because one was given this exocet-like instruction, and it seemed to go well.
Yeah.
The Harold sat in the third row, mouthing the words along with me, which was, I think, intended to be encouraging. It was about the most intimidating thing I've ever had to deal with in a performance, but it went well. And not long after that, Harold, as you said, was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. And then 3 years after that, his illness led to his death. And there were celebrations memorials in London, I think in New York, in Dublin. But there was nothing going on in Los Angeles where I happened to be. And I talked to his widow, Antonia Fraser, and thought I could represent this recital as a memorial tribute. And I would pepper it with extracts from obituaries and one or two people's thoughts and reflections and a sort of a homily of my own. And there was quite a gathering of folk who turned up for it. It was intended to be a one-off and afterwards a drink for Harold. But the response was so excited from people who had no knowledge of this body of work, the poetry, just as I had no knowledge of it. I was asked if I could come and do it again in someone's classroom, at a theatre, in someone's house. And clearly there was... the people were interested. There was an audience and they were listening. And John Malkovich, who's a friend of mine, we did our first film together, The Killing Fields, more than 30 years ago now. And when we first met, we discovered this mutual admiration for Harold's work. John had directed and appeared in many of his plays for Steppenwolf, and we would talk to each other in accurate and not always accurate Pinter dialogue. as we still do.
Right.
He felt very strongly that the content, if prepared and structured, could be a legitimate theatre experience, which could have great impact. And we talked about it, and we worked in it, and we followed each other around a little bit, sort of looking at more material, and came up through collaboration with this composite of what I would call a word portrait of Harold's, and the words mostly being Harold's, taken at its core from the poetry, but also his prose and extracts from conversations, but other people's observations and reminiscences and appreciations of him. Our aim was to create an entertainment. So anybody listening who thinks, gosh, this sounds a bit dry, don't worry at all. It's very funny and very tender. Yeah. Harold had a tremendous wit. He said he grew up in a household full of laughter, and something of that rubbed off in his thinking. The amazing revelation to me about the poetry was his capacity for romantic love. So I think some of the poems express romantic love as well as anything I've ever read in English literature. Ranks alongside Shakespeare and Yeats.
I'd actually like to have you read a poem here, if you don't mind. There are a number of poems that he writes for A being Antonia Fraser, his wife, longtime wife. And we'll come back to another one of those. But I wonder if it is here for A is one you wouldn't mind talking about and reading.
It is here for A is a poem he wrote, which is one of the greatest sort of expressions, I think, of enduring human love. It is here for A. What sound was that? I turn away into a shaking room. What was that sound that came in on the dark? What is this maze of light it leaves us in? What is this stance we take to turn away and then turn back? What did we hear? It was the breath we took when we first met. Listen, it is here.
You know, it's interesting when you hear the pronouns we, the pronoun we. It's different from the plays, isn't it? I mean, we is Harold Pinter in a poem. We isn't necessarily that in a play.
I think the voice of the author in the plays are most oblique, especially the earlier plays. It's arguable that the later plays, the more overtly, there is a sense of a more subjective voice of the author. But certainly in the poetry, what was the great revelation to me as I sat with Harold in his study almost 10 years ago was the openness and the ease with which he revealed his personal feelings, his thoughts, his beliefs, his emotional interior. And in a poem like It Is Here for A, the use of the pronoun we is so all-encompassing. I mean, anybody in the audience who has been in any kind of relationship, enduring relationship, sort of responds to the warmth and richness with which Harold seems to celebrate the humanity of enduring love.
Antonia Fraser, as I understand it, the presentation, the show, the one-man show, does tell the story of the relationship with Antonia. And she's written a terrific book where she pinpoints that moment when they first fell in love. It was at a dinner party, January of 1975. She's a respected biographer at the time. By then, he's, of course, world famous for his own work. But, of course, they were married to other people. But he says something to her so striking, it becomes the title of her book, of course. And that's the beginning of this extraordinary relationship.
Yes. I mean, for those listening, the dinner was to celebrate a revival of the birthday party. Antonia was a guest. She hadn't spoken to Harold, but it was getting on past 11, and she stood to say her goodbyes. Harold looked at her and said, "Must you go?" And they were to remain inseparable from that moment until his death 33 years later. And in spite of the circumstances, they were both married. Antonia had six children. She said, you know, they were just two middle-aged people who met each other and fell in love. And she has written about this in Must You Go, My Life with Harold Pinter. And I agree with you. It's a very moving and fascinating account of their life together. And it's told through diary entries contemporary commentaries on those diary entries. It's a wonderful document, I think. I do quote her book. It's a great reservoir of material for me. I mean, as are Michael Billington's wonderful biography, but mostly all the other actors and writers and directors who I've talked to who were familiar with Harold throughout his working life. Paris is where they found themselves shortly after that dinner. And this next poem is called Paris, Paris. The curtain white enfolds. She takes two steps and turns. The curtain still. The light staggers in her eyes. The lamps are golden. Afternoon leans silently.
Do you think Julian Sands' people were surprised that Harold Pinter had this in him? I mean, if you see his plays, you see menace and darkness and viciousnesses, as you've described it. And then these poems are so warm and so lovely.
Yeah. I mean, the Nobel citation for said Harold Pinter's returned theatre to its basic elements, a contained space, unpredictable dialogue, and characters at the mercy of each other. I mean, that was the Nobel Committee's summing up of his dramatic work. But these plays have such such tenderness and such as your warmth and feeling. It's sort of sweetness is a word. If many people might not associate with Harold Pinter, known for his unequivocal and abrasive manner, but there is real sweetness towards his subjects and towards his females in particular. I mean, he was a great romantic.
You know, it was in those heady first months of their relationship when he writes what you consider one of his most interesting and one of his most important poems. I mean, they had fallen in love in January, and then in February, he's in Hong Kong, and Antonia Fraser says that in her book that he wrote her two poems. And the short one is the one that has become such a critical part of your show, I Know the Place. You read it at various times throughout the show, and I wanted to talk to you about it. Have you read it, if you would, because it's such an important part, I think, of this story.
I can't tell you. I'm very happy to read this. I Know the Place. I know the place. It is true. Everything we do corrects the space between death and me and you.
There's such a great story with that. You figured there's a typo here when you first encountered this.
Oh, well, I was sitting in Harold's study, of course, you know, seeing these poems for the first time, he would hand them to me. I have to say, Doug, I felt quite anointed. I had no problem being a sort of middle-aged teacher's pet. And when I read this through, it was without hesitation. I said, oh, Harold, I think there's a typo here. And he looked at me. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, it says here, corrects the space. Surely it should be connects the space, shouldn't it? And he looked at me again and said, just read it. One day you might understand. Well, I've read it a good many times since then. And the reason I use the poem as a thread through the evening is largely because of the beauty and the metaphysical complexity mm-hmm. that the use of that word corrects brings to the piece. You know, after a performance in New York, somebody stayed behind. He was a nuclear physicist. And he said, I don't think I've ever heard in any kind of literature Einstein's theory of relativity so beautifully expressed as I know the place. It is true. Everything we do corrects the space between death and me and you.
Julian Sands is with us. He created the one-man show, a celebration of Harold Pinter. Friday evening at 7:30, he's performing at Weber State University's All Red Theater. For tickets and more information, call 801-626-8500. Or just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, for the particulars. We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the actor Julian Sands is joining us. He's coming to Utah this week to perform his one-man show, the playwright Harold Pinter, where he reads Pinter's prose, mostly his poetry, though. Pinter, of course, intense and brilliant, won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Sands has described being on the stage with his work as like having a bird of prey on your arm with the potential for something explosive to happen. We're talking about celebrating Harold Pinter. And Julia Sands, is that that's what it's like, I guess, a bird of prey.
Yes, the bird of prey. It may have been John who gave that metaphor to me. He said when you're in the room with Harold himself, quite apart from his work, there's this sort of feeling of this extraordinary animal presence. Mm-hmm. And I think in the introduction, when you talked about my suggesting his sort of electrical charge, I think animal magnetism is a better phrase. Mm-hmm. He had it. It made a very powerful impact on anybody who was within his range. Of course, that shielded a lot of people, blinded a lot of people too, what I've called his interior sensitivities, which are so beautifully and finely tuned. A lot of people know or may know that he was he took a very strong anti-war stance against the wars in Iraq and Bosnia, El Salvador, Nicaragua. He was vehement in against what he considered imperialist sort of foreign policies. And yet when he wrote poetry about the victims mm-hmm. of war, there was, again, this sort of extraordinary nobility informs his writing. I'd like to share a couple of these with you, if I may.
Please, of course.
The first is called The Disappeared. Lovers of light, the skulls, the burnt skin, the white flash of the night, the heat in the death of men, the hamstring and the heart, torn apart in a musical room, where the children of the light know that their kingdom has come. And next is meeting. It is the dead of night. The long dead look out towards the new dead, walking towards them. There is a soft heartbeat as the dead embrace those who are long dead and those of the new dead walking towards them. They cry and they kiss as they meet again for the first and last time.
You've described these war poems as having a kind of Homeric quality to them.
I think I stand by that. I think that there's a reporting of the consequence of human conflict, which in his later war poems, which has an entirely classical aspect to it. You know, I think Harold, this was also said of the English writer George Orwell, best known for 1984. The sign of medals and braid intended to impress, or the sound of marching bands. He wasn't diverted to a place of approval. He was simply reminded that somewhere in the world, a military boot is grinding a human face. And, you know, the violence of that and the specificity of it, I found very moving because it comes down to this sort of it's one man doing in another for all the sort of the glamour and the if that's the word and the removal of feeling, given the high-tech nature of a lot of conflict in the world, guided missiles and drone strikes and all of this. It puts us at a remove from this directly the direct engagement of one human bashing another in a prehistoric way.
You know, I'm not going to put you on the spot by asking you to read a poem that I don't even know if you consider for the piece, but the poem After Lunch, this was September of 2002. And if you sort of orient the time there, it's in all that tumult, of course, after 9/11 in the United States. And he writes about afternoon, the well-dressed creatures come to
After lunch. And afternoon, yes. The well-dressed creatures come to sniff among the dead and have their lunch. And all the many well-dressed creatures pluck the swollen avocados from the dust and stir the minestrone with stray bones. And after lunch, they loll and lounge about, decanting claret from convenient skulls.
I love that piece.
Yes, it's a sort of grotesque, Goya-esque landscape of he creates. And I do believe that had Harold not written plays, that his literary legacy and his reputation as a writer would have been colossal had he merely pursued poetry. He wrote poetry from his early teenage years. And throughout the period that he worked as an actor, he was writing poetry. So only in the late 50s, when one of his school friends was in desperate need of a play for at Bristol University, that he persuaded Harold to write something. And Harold said, "I'm not a playwright." He said, "Yes, you are. You just write me something. I need it by next week." Wow. And that was what brought into existence The Room. And because of The Room came The Birthday Party and The Caretaker and The Dumbwaiter and Homecoming and No Man's Land and, you know, all the other great plays which have entered the what I would call the classical repertory around the world. I don't know how much Harold is performed in America. Yes, in New York, yes, in Los Angeles and San Francisco. I don't know how actively he's performed elsewhere.
Yeah.
Chicago, yes. I saw a production of The Birthday Party there 2 years ago. Will the students of Weber
State
be familiar with his body of work, do you suppose?
I suppose not, actually, which is why this is so good for all of us, I have to say.
Yes. Well, good.
Yeah.
Then I'm very happy I'll be in town.
Yes.
Because anybody, you don't have to know anything about Harold or his – I mean, this is wonderful that we can talk about him and share these insights for your audience. And but you don't need to have any prior knowledge to enjoy the evening with me.
Well, of course. I think that – and I think people will know of Harold Pinter on paper. But again, this is what's so remarkable about this performance is that we'll come to know him in a different way as well. I want to have you read one more war poem, if you would. The Bombs,
yes.
If you wouldn't
yes.
mind.
The Bombs. There are no more words to be said. All we have left are the bombs which burst out of our head. All that is left are the bombs which suck out the last of our blood. All we have left are the bombs which polish the skulls of the dead.
Julian Sands created The One Man Show, a celebration of Harold Pinter. Friday evening at 7:30, he's performing at Weber State University's All Red Theater. For tickets and more information, you can call the school, 801-626-8500, or you can get the particulars on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the actor Julian Sands is with us. We're talking about his one-man show, which he's bringing to Weber State University this Friday. It's called A Celebration of Harold Pinter. You can get the details on our website. We'll give you the particulars a little bit later as we go. So I'm trying to imagine you then facing Harold Pinter there in his study as he tutors you on the way to deliver this recital properly. And I take it he didn't want you to move around so much or even at all. At least I've read that this idea that theater is ultimately not spectacle, he said, but sound. So I'm wondering, did you do much blocking? Did he want you moving at all?
That's an interesting quote you brought up. You know, in Elizabethan times, people would talk about going to hear a play. Right. Let's go and hear the new play at the Globe. Rather than to see a play. We always talk about, let's go and see a play. Right. But the idea of hearing the play is centuries centuries old. No, he didn't want blocking. He wanted stillness. And when John and I first started working together on presenting the material, I think my instinct was to sort of move it around a bit, create some visual diversion. And John was very, very clear that stillness was the way to go, not to give visual distraction to the power of the work, to trust the work. That was one of John's keenest early observations. It was so helpful. And of course, there is my physical presence, and there is the specter of Harold hovering around. It's not we don't have dynamic blocking, nobody's ever asked for their money back. I think that, I mean, and you asked, you know, do I play Harold? No, I don't play him. There are moments when I sort of channel his voice because it expresses, if I'm quoting him, his material requires a certain approach, which is, it was given to me by Harold, and of course he wrote these only really with the idea of himself performing them. He was very protective of his performances, his presentations of his poetry. It was not an easy thing for him to sort of relinquish the particular recital on which he and I collaborated. But it was the only time, I mean, that he ever worked with anybody on this poetry. So it came as a gift, and it is as a gift that I, you know, it motivates me to share this, to pass it on, and to keep and also because I continue to find the material increasingly fascinating. I think you may have said in your introduction there's a sort of there's a uniqueness to each presentation because it's an organic response to what I feel's going on with the audience and what's appropriate and the whatever my mood might be. I mean, I have a playlist in my head of material, which I shuffle according to the circumstances of the particular evening.
I'm interested in that because, I know you choose certain poems one night and others maybe another, but so are you taking into account the difference between, performing this play in Edinburgh or London or some, kind of sophisticated European setting and Utah, is seen as this kind of conservative bastion.
I don't take it into consideration thinking somehow, oh, London's sophisticated, Utah ain't. No.
Right. No,
but I take into consideration, I would say the reverse was most likely true. I take into consideration the atmosphere and the mood I sense and shift. There is a structure which I have evolved and keep to, but the variations are probably more to do with my own personal mood and whatever I did last time. I want to explore something else this time. Do you see?
Yeah, of course.
As I said, I continue to be to discover new layers, new depth, new thoughts, and ideas and feelings in this body of work, this material, this collective of the poems and prose, and which forms the portrait. We call it a celebration of Harold Pinter because I think that best expresses what this word portrait is. It's not just an image of the man. It's not just an examination of the man. It's a real. It's a triumvirate of the man. It's a triumphant bugle call to his life and work.
I wanted to have you read some of the so-called life poems. He of course has cancer. It's the disease that kills him eventually. Cancer Cells is a powerful poem. I wonder if you could talk about that and read that.
Well, cancer came into Harold's life at the beginning of the 21st century, and it was a battle. And this poem, Cancer Cells, was the first time he addressed his illness in his writing. And it was a response to something said by a nurse at the Royal Marsden Cancer Hospital in London. And she said, "Cancer cells are those which have forgotten how to die." And in 2002, Harold wrote Cancer Cells. "They have forgotten how to die and so extend their killing life. I and my tumor dearly fight. Let's hope a double death is out. I need to see my tumor dead, a tumor which forgets to die but plans to murder me instead. But I remember how to die, though all my witnesses are dead. But I remember what they said of tumors which would render them as blind and dumb as they had been before the birth of that disease which brought the tumor into play. The black cells will dry up and die, or sing with joy and have their way. They breed so quietly night and day. You never know. They never say."
There's a poem from that he wrote in 1983 called Ghost, which I don't know what to make of. I'm not sure where that was coming from.
The poem of Ghost, I call that poem an elegy. Or a nocturne. It's really an elegy to a former love, his first wife, the actress Vivian Marchant. Mm. At the time that Harold met Antonia in 75, they were still together, but to all intents and purposes, the relationship had disintegrated, and Harold was set to leave regardless of meeting Antonia. But he has said of his time with Vivian, you know, they had good times. They had it was a good marriage in many ways. But they were young when they got together. They were both, you know, just actors in traveling actors in repertory in England. And by the time they were in their middle age, things had changed and they'd evolved into different people. But Harold was not without considerable feeling for Vivian. And after she died, he wrote Ghost. "I felt soft fingers at my throat. It seemed someone was strangling me. The lips were hard as they were sweet. It seemed someone was kissing me. My vital bones about to crack. I gaped into another's eyes. I saw it was a face I knew. A face as sweet as it was grim. It did not smile. It did not weep. Its eyes were wide and white its skin. I did not smile. I did not weep. I raised my hand and touched its cheek." I think what the poem explores and is some kind of reconciliation. The sort of it's about the psychic energy of a relationship doesn't just end when the relationship ends or when a person dies. And I think it's about, I think the poem's about making peace with that turbulence, psychic turbulence, which can continue beyond the life of a relationship. Does that make sense, Doug?
Of course, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. It's such a beautiful... I'd never thought of it in that way, but I think... There are two more things I want to get to.
Yes.
Harold Pinter's Nobel speech. It is his manifesto for his art and for his politics. And I wanted to play that last moment of this because I want to have you talk about this. Antonia called it. It's interesting. She writes about, of course, he couldn't go to Stockholm, as you said, to deliver it. So he had to go to this BBC studio. And Antonia Fraser called it a masterly, deceptive speech. She says, starting right where you would want him to go, with the art part, with the enigma part and all of that, she says, and then, pow, as she puts it in her book, exactly where most probably didn't want him to go, and that was to the politics part,
yes.
This mirror part. Shall we play this part and have you talk about it?
But yes, I would love to hear Harold.
When we look into a mirror, we think the image that confronts us is accurate. But move a millimetre and the image changes. We are actually looking at an ever-ending range of reflections. But sometimes a writer has to smash the mirror. For it is on the other side of that mirror that the truth stares at us. I believe that despite the enormous odds which exist, unflinching, unswerving, fierce intellectual determination as citizens to define the real truth of our lives and our societies is a crucial obligation which devolves upon us all. It is, in fact, mandatory. If such a determination is not embodied in our political vision, we have no hope of restoring what is so nearly lost to us. The dignity of man.
The real truth of our lives. That mirror was an important metaphor for him.
It's a most important metaphor. There's a piece of prose Harold wrote the year before called The Mirror. And it explores the notion of a dying man, looking into the mirror and seeing a face he refuses to accept as his own, but through the piece of prose he does reconcile himself to this face of this stranger becomes the face of his familiar, the face of himself. And I think to a degree Harold, when using the metaphor of the mirror, again, moving a millimeter and the image changes. Mm-hmm. We're actually looking at a never-ending series of reflections. I think it's about his insistence on the need for absolute clarity in sight and with insight is how I understand that portion of the last paragraph.
I want to have you read one more poem. Let's go back to a love poem, 2A. This was written in the summer of 2007, and keep in mind he dies in 2008. And it's interesting to read what Antonia Fraser has to say about the poem. She says she recognized it for what it was, which is a farewell. And she says that the first line, which you'll read, gave her a jolt. Harold Pinter was quite pleased with himself for coming up with this idea that of the dead missing the living rather than the other way around.
Very pleased with him. He read that poem to me. He said, when we're at another lunch, he said, look, I've just written this. I want you to hear it because I'm brilliant. And I too was shocked. But this is poem to A. I shall miss you so much when I'm dead. The loveliest of smiles, the softness of your body in our bed. My everlasting bride, remember that when I am dead, you are forever in my heart and my head.
You've talked about this performance as something that evolves, like it's a search for Harold Pinter, who he really, really was. Do you think you'll ever get him completely, ever truly find
well,
him?
Well, I think, if you like, I see myself as a bodhisattva showing people the way to Harold. So it's not really about my own search, right. My own journey. It's about shining the light on him for the benefit of others who may. I have a very strong and very personal and I think quite complete appreciation and understanding of the man. But every person I meet who has had contact with Harold or experiences with him, or whenever I discover a piece of writing and see it in a different way, of course, I realize that my knowledge and understanding of him is far from complete. So I enjoy the search. I enjoy the pilgrimage.
Actor Julian Sands. This Friday evening, he's performing his one-man show, A Celebration of Harold Pinter, at Weber State University. That show begins at 7:30. For details about that, it's at the university's All Red Theater. Go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Julian Sands joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Julian, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.